Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, and welcome to the bonus episode of Sentimental Garbage. Here I'm talking to the author of Unsticky, Sarah Manning, about sex scenes, Mills and Boone, the publishing industry, and why still the most creative professions are the hardest to get into. All right, I'm going to get started properly.
Okay, then.
Hello, Sarah Manning. Thank you so much for having me in your living room.
Oh, thank you for coming all the way to Muswell Hill.
It's quite the trek in the icy January winds. I'd like to hear a little bit about your experience with writing this book, what brought it about, what that time in your life was. Because a little while ago now.
Yes. I think it was around 2006, 2007. So I'd been writing teen books, as we called them then, now known as YA, for ages, and had just done it in a kind of really haphazard fashion. I was working full time. I didn't have an agent. And so it was kind of, I got made redundant and I was sort of doing shifts and things. Really wanted to write an adult book and I got an agent. It was like, this is time to get your shit together. So I got an agent with the view that I was going to sort of like write adult books. She was going to help me. I remember we just went and had a meeting at Headline just to sort of like say hi. And it was actually with the wonderful Harriet Evans, who was an editor at Headline then. And now she's a lady writer.
Ooh.
And I don't think I had a really sort of concrete idea of what this like amazing adult book was going to be. But I just found myself kind of pitching this kind of younger man, sort of older woman.
Older man, younger woman.
Just, you know, because I just grew up on Mills and Boone. I was raised on my mother's Mills and Boones. I was raised on Daddy Longlegs. I was sort of raised on books with like sardonic older men and sort of flighty young girls. And I kind of loved that trope, but then, you know, I was the age I was where I was sort of like in my late 20s, you know, I didn't love that trope quite so much, having just sort of experienced all the delights that sort of like modern manhood sort of has to offer. So I just sort of wanted to sort of take kind of that trope, which is just such a staple of romantic novels, and do something really sort of real with it. And just also that kind of sort of relationship, there's kind of a weird power dynamic and there's kind of a transactional sort of quality to it. And also at the time I'd been working on fashion magazines, don't even ask me how, but I'd worked on Elle magazine for a bit, and
that's proper fashion as well.
It was like, well, I was working on Elle Girl, which was just the best magazine. It was like a junior Elle.
I loved it. I used to get it.
So fab. Good.
But I loved it.
It was always, we'd do an issue and then we'd be put on hiatus and never know if there was going to be another issue. And they sort of bumped me upstairs to Elle, which actually it was really sort of lovely. And everybody was really kind, you know, and I just sort of sat on the features and sang show tunes all day and just kind of was a disruptive influence. But then when I was freelancing, I did a lot of celebrity stuff for Elle, of like being flown to LA to sort of like do cover interviews, which was just the most terrifying thing. But it was quite, especially with Unsticky, I just kind of had this sort of defining moment where we'd sort of flown into sort of LAX. And they had all the clothes for the shoot, and you're meant to fill in a customs declaration, but nobody ever does because you often end up having to pay extra, and these things are always sort of done on a shoestring. So you'd have to just pretend that it was like your personal clothing. You know?
These are online.
Yeah, you know, this kind of like Cavalli and Versace. Yeah, they've got the tags on, but they're all mine for my personal use. And so the fancy, like, high sort of fashion ladies were just like, well, we're not waiting to go through sort of like customs, and just sort of swanned off. And I was left with the fashion assistant, and she just said, Sarah, can you just wait with me? Because I do not have any money to, like, get a car to the hotel, you know, and I need you to do it and put it on your expenses, because I haven't even... And it was just this sort of... this just sort of dual kind of existence that, you know, the fashion assistants on these magazines, unless you're sort of really posh, and a lot of them are really posh, it's a bit like publishing, you know, where you're sort of... there's family handouts and there's kind of sort of money... You know, if not, you're just sort of living on, like, no money, but you know, there's just all these beautiful dresses every day, and you're kind of staying in a sort of hotel in LA, but actually you've only got enough money to go to sort of Duane Reade and get yourself some, like, Doritos and a salsa dip.
Oh my goodness.
Kind of quite fascinated by that duality. And then just some of it was, like, my sort of life 5 years previously, because I lived in that bed sitting archway...
That's
with a
real
shared
message.
Bathroom that did actually freeze up. I'd gone to house sit in Hampstead over Christmas, and when I got back, we were having a cold snap, and I went into the bathroom, and we had no water, but there was, like, the infamous yellow ice in the toilet bowl.
Ooh.
And it was just... And I remember my editor at the time just saying, this is completely unrealistic. Nobody who lives like this. And I was like, well, yeah... I live like this. So yeah.
I mean, that's the bit of the book I related to the most. And I suppose so Grace kind of came alive with that fashion assistant who was handling all these beautiful garments and yet couldn't afford her own taxi. And I think this will always be a relevant book, because there will always be 23-year-olds trying to make it in these environments that both need them but don't want them, where you're handling with all this incredible merchandise and yet you can't argue for an extra, like, $2,000 a year so you can pay your rent. And, like, what's so fascinating about this book and Grace and the relationship she has with Vaughn, who ends up having to sort of pay for her existence, is that every female character in the book has their existence paid for by a man, whether it's their husband or their father or something. Somebody is footing the bill. And yet, when Grace has this... What kind of starts out as being basically sex work, right? If we're...
Well...
I mean, it's an arrangement, but it is, you know, a form
of
sex work.
Well, it's an interesting thing, though. You have to sort of, like...
Yeah, that's when everybody gets all moral about it, though, you know?
But, you know, her point was always, before, you know, Vaughn sort of wanted her to sort of have this arrangement. And can I just point out that I wrote this book before 50 Shades of Grey...
This book is much better, much sexier than Fifty Shades of Grey.
But, you know, she would have shagged him anyway, so they still...
Yeah, she comes back to that a lot, doesn't she?
They had that sexual attraction anyway, and it's just, what is sort of the nature of sort of, like, relationships? You know, it goes back to this kind of, this well-trodden sort of, like, younger woman, older man trope. You know, when is a relationship, when is an arrangement... It's just, you know, you could be sort of married and not working.
Yeah.
Which personally would just, like, really sort of sit uncomfortably with me. There's just, I don't, there's 50 Shades of Grey, isn't there? It's just these kind of sort of nebulous sort of things. I mean, you know, if he's going to go out with somebody like that, she can't sort of turn up, can she, sort of like in a...
Yeah, and that's
Primark dress to go to some fancy kind of art opening.
What's so interesting, and this is a massive spoiler, is that when it comes to the kind of towards the end, when he realizes how destitute she actually is, and he sort of says, like, this was pin money, you know, I didn't think that this was your whole existence. I didn't think you actually needed to do this. Was that really important for you that, like, because he is, he's such an interesting, sexy, intriguing character, because he's such a bad bastard for such a lot of the book. Like, you know, he does dreadful things to her and he puts her through dreadful situations, but then when the kind of scales fall away and he realises how vulnerable she is, he doesn't take advantage of her. He really just provides in a way that is, I don't know, you know, he really comes through for her.
Yeah. It's just, people are quite sort of clueless. I remember when I was writing it and I had to do, like, a massive... edit on it when I handed it in, like, oh, this is brilliant, 33-page editorial letter.
Wow.
And one of the things was that my editor was just like, these allowances, this is a huge amount of money, so I don't understand why she's in debt. And she was really, she's a great editor, but she didn't know much about fashion. Mm-hmm. And I actually just literally had to spell it out the way that Kiki does in the book, that this money is nothing, to sort of kind of, you know, to kind of look like she's living the lifestyle that Vaughan wants her to sort of, you know, that money is just sort of like pissed away. It takes a lot to sort of look that good.
Yeah, and it all kind of, she gets, you know, I think it's about $5,000 a month or something, and or $7,000 if you count in her clothing allowance.
Yes.
But it all feeds back into his business. It's not just for his pleasure. He gains a lot of business through her charisma, through her sort of being able to mix well with people.
And he's kind of, so in the book he's kind of, you know, got a nose for like this second wave of like young British artists that he couldn't gain access to on his own. So he sort of needs, you know, Grace's kind of street cred and, you know, her sort of Hoxton credentials to getting in. So it's, again, it's that weird sort of power dynamic of like who's in charge, and sort of as they get to sort of know each other and sort of have like proper sort of feelings for each other, that's sort of, it's like a sort of seesaw, and it's kind of constantly sort of, you know, swinging sort of one way or another. I just sort of find that whole kind of sort of dynamic between couples quite interesting. I'm obsessed with like the Real Housewife franchise.
Really? What city is your main thing?
New York, obviously. But I'm doing, I'd really just like done them all, but I've saved up like Orange County for like Dark Days, which are here, and I'm kind of like halfway through season 5, and there's this woman, Alexis, and she's married to this awful man. He's just vile. And they both sort of say that they're godly Christians, although they're both on their second marriages. Mm-hmm. She doesn't work. She's sort of given him children. She's not allowed to sort of like go out without him. Mm-hmm. He expects her to dress, you know, she dresses in a very sort of sexually kind of
provocative
way, but then he sort of, which he enjoys, and she's got what I call Jesus jugs, like these huge boobs, but then he's always sort of saying to her, you know, sit down, I don't want other men looking at your ass. And but then, you know, they're a sort of respectable Christian married couple, but you know, well, he's just, you know, she's saying, I love him and I wanted a certain lifestyle. So just because you've got like a ring on your finger and a certificate, that doesn't sort of make that relationship better or sort of more valid or kind of more kosher than
what Grace and Vaughan go through. I'd love to talk a little bit more, if it's not too embarrassing, about the sex in the book. Because the shagging is so hot, and it's really weird to sit next to someone on their couch and like talk about how turned on you were by their work. But I was very turned on by your work. And what I loved as well is I'd never ever read a book before where someone's not orgasming is such a huge plot point. Like, the sex scenes genuinely move the plot forward, you know, in a way that has genuinely helped my writing. So I was finishing my second book as I was reading this, and I was like, the sex scenes aren't doing enough, and it really made me like punch them up some more.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I've written teen, and my teen was kind of, well, it was, you know, was about as adult as teen could get. So my protagonists were always kind of 17, and they would have sex, and it wouldn't automatically fade to black. But, you know, there just wasn't much talk of body parts or anything. So when it came to write Unstitching,
you were just bottled up, were you?
It was like stabiliser wheels have come off. And I was just like, oh, I'm just going to go for it. And I had to cut out loads of the sex scenes because just so many of them were gratuitous. But, you know, I have very strong ideas about sex in books. I think something that really sort of helped me is I just read a lot of, you know, I've always read a lot of fanfic. And just, really? I just maintain, as I know, sort of probably Ella does as well, some of the best writing I've ever read has been like fanfic, you know. And some of those NC-17 fanfics, it's quite funny, they're called
NC-17?
Yeah, it's kind of the American sort of rating.
Right, right.
But they also call them PWP, which stands for Porn Without Plot. But it's
so what was your favourite like pairing of fanfiction?
gosh, I don't think I can say Caroline.
Okay. Well, I read one the other day, and it was so hilarious. So someone sent it to me, said that it was this is brilliant fanfic, and what it was Devil Wears Prada, Miranda Priestly, and Anne Hathaway's character Andrea fall in love, which is, you know, fine, yes, great. But like the majority of the fanfiction, and it's about 30,000 words long, they always are huge. There's almost no sex in it at all. It's just about like managing redundancies at the magazine. It's like, this isn't much of a fantasy. This is cold reality.
Oh, but I mean, I sort of was really, you know, I did read a lot of sort of Buffy fanfic, although Buffy and was not
Buffy and
name.
Spike is no, a great model
yeah,
here.
But, you know, wasn't my favourite pairing.
Okay.
But, you know, I just sort of knew how I wanted to sort of write sex in a really sort of honest way and just call things what they are. Mm. I think I read a Candace Bush book, and in her sex scene, she actually referred to the penis and the vagina. It's just like, no, you know, just call a cock a cock, you know. But it's just also, you know, how people talk when they're, you know, having... So, but it was really sort of important for me, you know, that in this kind of... that I wanted to sort of be honest and sort of real about how these sort of relationships are. You know, she's 23, she's been out with a load of really toxic men.
Yeah.
Of course she's never had an orgasm. Of course she hasn't, you know. It's just... there's that sort of line where she just says to her... I think Lily, her friend, says, you know, when she says that she's had an orgasm before, and her friend Lily says, but I thought you said you couldn't have an orgasm unless you climbed on top and really wriggled. You know, it's just... And I think 23 just is like a baby. You just know nothing.
23 is, I think, a very unexplored age. I thought about this a lot because my book I've just written, the characters are 23 and 24. And I think it's that weird age that people don't focus on enough where, like, it's that not a girl, not yet a woman thing. Of,
yeah,
like,
definitely.
You have all the trappings of adult life. You have a job, you have a flat, you have a social order of some sort and responsibilities and bills, etc., a credit card, but you don't have a fucking clue how to make your way in the world. It's a really lonely time, and it's often a time as well where the herd is being separated, where the people who are going to be really successful start making those first strides forward. And if you're not making those strides, you often feel like you're like, oh my god, is this the kind of adult I'm going to be? Is this, you know?
I think it's like Grace says that she knows like the carb units and sort of the calories and every M&S ready meal. But, you know, she's kind of missed that memo on, like, you know, the other girls have got about how to have, like, really good sex.
Yeah.
And this is where it's, like, the benefits of sort of being with an older man, you know, that Vaughan sort of sees it as kind of, you know, he's quite offended, A, that she hasn't had an orgasm, but also that she wouldn't sort of tell him, you know, be sort of more vocal kind of about what she sort of wanted. It is just a really sort of odd age. I mean, that was what was really sort of difficult for me writing Unsticky, because it's like I'm going to write an adult novel now. But it took me about 10 goes before I had something ready to sort of send out, and my agent just kept saying no, because, you know, if my YA heroines were 17 and Grace was 23, 6 years, but in that 6 years there sort of lies sort of multitudes, and I just couldn't really sort of... She was still too teen and sort of like flouncing off every sort of 5 seconds.
Mm.
And just that, there's some sort of really sort of, I think it was sort of Daisy Buchanan when we were sort of talking about Unsticky. She said, nothing has changed and everything's changed in those sort of 6 years.
Mm.
And it wasn't actually until I sort of, I actually flipped it to third person, which I'd never written in before.
Yeah, that was interesting. I was going to ask, was that the choice? Why?
That was why. It just, there was something about writing in third person that just made, ironically, sort of just the Grace's voice sort of come alive in a way, because all my YA is first person, which I really love, because there's something about first person that's just kind of sort of quite breathless and excited. And so it did also feel like I was a proper writer doing the third person.
I've never written in the third person either. I feel like a weird sort of 47 years ago. You know what I mean?
And I've been told now, it wasn't until like an editor told me that I did this, I was like, oh, okay, I write really close third person.
Mm.
So it's kind of, it's third person, but you're kind of right inside that character. Yeah, there's a lot of kind of inner narrative. But that was sort of like the magic sort of switch.
Yeah, because it's third person, but it doesn't head hop. You're not like, you don't suddenly go to Vaughan and see what he's thinking. No. You never know anything that Grace doesn't know.
I've done that with Becky Sharp, though, because that's what Thackeray does. And again, it was like, oh my God, I'm a proper writer. I'm doing my multi-point of view third person.
It's so funny, you've been making your career as a writer for so long and you still have that feeling
I
of like...
I do. There's just, you know, I started writing for teen magazines, which I loved, but you know, it didn't... You know, and then I did YA novels, and it was kind of like, one day, you know, I'll write a grown-up novel.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was sort of like, I write a grown-up novel, but what I really want to do is write sort of period. You know, it's always... I just wish sometimes I could just be happy with kind of what I have instead of just worrying.
Yeah,
about...
but if you were happy, why would you write?
Well, yeah, that's
like, you
the
just
thing.
Go and have a, you know...
I suppose once you're complacent, just kind of, you know, that hungriness goes. But it does, but it always just sort of feels like I kind of, it's like we were saying before, that I kind of achieve things by kind of stealth and kind of like going behind people's backs. And I'm just, and then they turn around, I'm like, oh, hi.
Oh, really just me, never mind.
Don't worry about me. You just get on with what you were doing.
I remember, like, a part of me genuinely thought that the minute I had a book on the shelves, I would never get another spot again. Do you mean that I would just change and transform and just be someone who's proper?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
One of our guests actually on this season, Julie Cohen, her name is, she said something very interesting on her episode. She says, her theory is, all women's writing comes from three places, one of three places. It's either Austen, so it's, you know, rom-com or whatever. It's Bronte's, so it's, you know, gothic, troubling, all this kind of stuff. Or it's Eliot, so it's like social order and what we're all doing. Do you agree with that?
No, not at all. Don't like Brontes.
Yeah.
Haven't read any Eliot.
Because I kind of thought Jane and Rochester had a vibe in here.
Yeah, but it is just because it's the trope, isn't it?
Yeah.
I can't abide the Brontes. All really? That kind of like, as Virginia Woolf said, mopping and mowing about the highways. It's just too histrionic for me. And I love Jane Austen, but... certainly, I can't really see much of her in... No. Well, it would be Lydia, wouldn't it? Lydia and Wickham, really.
It would be Lydia and Wickham, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nice... I couldn't sort of, like, think of my writing in those terms.
No.
I mean, I just... Basically, I think all my books are just summed up as sort of boy meets girl meets rock meets hard place, you know?
But there's, like... Well, I just think that because everyone knows that convention so well, it gives you incredible space to explore other things.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to do with Unsticky. It's just, you know, when you sort of know the mechanics of sort of like romance novels back to front, then let's do something different with it.
Yeah, exactly. You relax with the structure and then you can just enjoy the detail, you know?
The funny thing is, you know, like I say, it was really hard to get a deal. It went out on submission... Back in the days when you could get a deal on a partial manuscript.
I can't believe there was ever a day of that.
It was, believe me. And, you know, it got rejected a lot. One editor even felt the need to write to my agent and just tell her that she was repulsed by...
Repulsed.
And, you know, like I say, I do think it was underpublished.
I agree. I think it should be republished. I think it should be a Borrego Modern Classic, to be honest.
It came out for a second time under Transworld with a new cover, and it was at the time of 50 Shades of Grey. I was just like, put a 50 Shades of Grey cover on it, just do it.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, no. But it is, you know, you don't have to say you love me so more, but there's just something about Unsticky that people sort of really, sort of weirdly kind of obsessed with it. Like, you know, I met some people from Mills and Boone at the thing, and they were like, we love Unsticky, we have copies in the office, you know, this is kind of, you know, what we think Mills and Boone should be, you know.
It should be.
You know, and I was kind of, it was really nice to me because, you know, I had grown up on Mills and Boone, and I would never sort of talk of Mills and Boone in a sort of sneering way, because, you know, I just sort of think... I just have like this real sort of thing about sort of women's writing, sort of by women, for women, is always just sort of talked about in a sort of really sort of sneering sort of way. But this is kind of, in so many ways, how we sort of figure out the world. And just some of the Mills and Boons that I read growing up, you know, just Sally Bowman, who was like a really successful kind of novelist in her own right, she wrote Mills and Boone, which I read... Vanessa James, they are like some of the best written, just sort of most amazing sort of romances.
Really?
You know, and sort of Mills and Boone are just this amazing kind of social history documents, but just also they really sort of chart the changes in sort of women's role in society, but how relationships change. So when I was sort of reading Mills and Boone's in the 80s, there were, you know, they were sort of couples living together and stuff. So I was actually really sort of flattered that sort of, you know...
That must be a wonderful thing to hear.
Yeah, you know. I mean, I will always just sort of cheer on the side of sort of romance novels in all their sort of like amazing variety, because, you know, it isn't just sort of boy meets girl, happy ever after.
Yeah.
You know, there's just so many sort of ways that you can sort of get to that place. But interestingly enough... I think sort of one of my problems when I was sort of doing these sort of contemporary novels for the first time, I just had a real bee in my bonnet about, like, no, happy endings aren't realistic. And
because you really feel like that you're gearing up for an unhappy ending for, like, two-thirds of this book, right? And then she starts to fall in love with him. Like, or they start to fall in love with each other in this very, very deep, very lovely, homely, domestic way. It's really satisfying.
But I really fought, like, tooth and claw. I was just not going to have that ending where it's like, I love you. Oh, my God, I love you too. It was really important to me not to do that. And then with You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, there's sort of another... It's a sweet ending, but there's no sort of, like, massive, you know, declaration... Mm. And I was sort of doing that with all my books. And then two things happened. I read a Marion Keyes thing. She said it's just fucking rude not to give people a happy ending.
And then, Marion say that?
Yeah,
amazing.
And I was just like, you're right.
It is fucking rude.
It's fucking rude. And then one of my best friends, Kate, is like covered in tattoos. And she sort of plays in a Monk's cover band. And she's just like rock and roll. She just goes, I love happy endings, Sarah. I love happy... And I was just like... People want happy endings.
People can take maybe one sad ending in a decade. I remember Titanic. I remember that fucking me up and being like, that's not how it goes. How dare you?
There was room for him on the door.
Right. Once in a generation we get one of those heartbreaks, but like in between, it is fucking rude.
It's fucking rude.
It's the most satisfying thing I've heard all day.
It's so true. And also as I get older, you know, I'm not so interested in being sort of like... clever and sort of a tricksy writer. Just want, you know, you just want to write like really good stories that sort of resonate with people.
And so what was the reader reaction to this? Was it kind of like a trickle that came in over time and then just kept coming in? Because like Jean, who I'm interviewing for this, has brought this up with me, and I've only met Jean once and I've had like a few, you know, chats with her online, but she always like, have you tried Unsticky, have you read Unsticky, for like 3 years, like, have you read Unsticky yet?
But it's just, you know, because it came out, I think it was first published in 2009. So even though, you know, there was Amazon and stuff, people just didn't review in the same way that they review now, where...
Yeah. Oh, you didn't really have as much of a sense of what people thought or felt, did you?
No. But then I would just sort of meet people and they would just be, like, really obsessed with it.
It gets under your skin. I think because partly because it's so long, because it's so breezy. I read it in a weekend, and I'm a slow reader, and it's 400 pages long, something like that.
It's longer.
You
actually,
spend so much time with these people, well, like you really get to know them.
I learned an important lesson. It was too long. I think I had to cut a lot, but it still weighed in at 175,000 words. I think the finished book that is. Long, when they tell you like 80 to 100,000 is a novel.
Yeah.
So it was like super long.
So how long was the, what was the word count? Sorry?
I think when I handed it in, it was something like 220,000.
No.
And I cut it down to 175,000. Here's a tip if for any novelists or would-be novelists. Don't write long books because you won't get translation deals.
Oh.
Because they're going to have to, you know, so novels are like between 80 to 100,000. So basically they're going to have to pay a translator to translate those extra 75,000.
That's a real shame. Because this would have done bonkers in France, wouldn't
well, it? Well, it did get a German deal in the end because they bought another book first. And I had to agree they would cut another 50,000 words. And then they sent me the manuscript with the words that they were going to cut. And I looked at the first page and I just thought, you know what, you're just better off not knowing. I was just like, they could just do what they...
Yeah, it makes no difference to you.
Yeah, so, you know, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me was really long, but not as long. And as I've sort of...
You refined your process over the years.
As I've wended my weary way across the publishing landscape, I have learned to write shorter, actually.
Really?
Yes.
So me and Lucy Vine, who came on to talk about Watermelon, we have a theory, because both of our first books were written over the space of 3 or 4 months. And not the time frame within the book is 3 or 4 months. And we think that debut novelists don't know how to cut to different times. And this is the same. This is like 5 or 6 months.
I know.
Yeah. No debut novelist is ever like, and then 6 years later, and then 2 years
yes.
later. You just like, no, every day she wakes up and does a new yes. thing. You know?
And then she did this, and then she did that, and then she ate her breakfast, and then she walked to the door.
It's like you don't trust yourself to do a transition at all. And then Tuesday, and then Wednesday. And like, I thought you used to get so head up about like, okay, now it's June, now it's July.
Yeah.
I had like an actual wall calendar up marking off all the days.
But it's, I would just get really sort of bothered about, you know, there was one book I wrote and I was just really worried that they just seemed to spend a lot of time at opening doors and standing in halls
yes.
and having conversations.
Totally.
And stuff. But then, you know, I think wherever you are in your sort of writing career, you just have problems. I mean, it's just that sort of cliche. Every book you write, you end up sort of like yeah. copy editing it. And it's just like, oh my God, there's people shrugging.
Why did I make this stupid...
Like left, right and centre. I only allow myself one arched eyebrow per book.
Oh my God, my fucking first copy edit was just... You'd swear people were just eyebrows.
I can't even arch an eyebrow myself, ironically.
I know, people furrowing, arching. Like, eyebrows are just not as expressive as people make out they are in books. Like, if an alien were to read just literature, they would think that the human body is just one eyebrow. And supple muscles.
A very voluble eyebrow, yeah. But, yeah, it is too long. And yet, you know...
No, it's not!
But then I've still got, like, all the stuff I cut from it as well.
Oh, I would like to read it. Bet you would, you dirty bitch.
And also, like, Grace was just sort of... I mean, she's... I think, you know, people did really respond to Grace in that she wasn't sort of a typical heroine. Mm. And she was quite truculent and sulky. But in earlier versions, she was just an outright bitch. She was
really?
Just like, yeah. And I didn't even notice I'd
think
done that.
That, because lots of times people are like, God, you're a bit of a bitch, aren't you? I was like, she's quite nice.
But she was just, and it's not until, you know, this is why you have editors. And so I sort of handed in the book and my editor was just like, she's just, you know, sighing and huffing and puffing and just sort of being nothing, you know, nothing makes her happy. She's just a bitch. And I was just like, oh. My God, she's a bitch.
And then you're like, am I a bitch? I'm actually very curious about the title. How did you land on Sticky?
Oh, God, well...
Is it one of those?
It was really difficult. It was so hard. I just didn't have a title. Kind of playing around with the idea of, like, mistresses and stuff.
Mm.
And it was, you know, I'd had this 10 attempts and I just didn't have a title. I think I might even have had a deal and not had a title.
Yeah.
I just took it right to the wire. And people have come up with some quite disturbing kind of like reasons that they believe it's called Unsticky, all to do with sort of like lubrication and Grace's inability to orgasm. Just like, no, it basically comes from, I can never remember if it's an epigram or an epigraph, the one that's at the front.
Oh yeah, no, I find that confusing also. Yeah,
well, whatever it is, you know, this is just also one of the inspirations for Unsticky. It's a line from Ian Forster's Where Angels Fear to Tread. And it just says, I seem to pass through life without ever colliding with it. If other people fall in love, they do it when I'm not around.
Yeah.
And it was just this idea of both Grace and Vaughan being those people that are just sort of passing through life without ever colliding with it, without, you know, both of them sort of feeling like they don't make an impression on anyone.
Right, right.
Or just not being sort of loved or sort of forming those sort of, you know, deep human connections. So that was kind of where Unsticky came from. Two people that were kind of not sticking to anything meaningful, any one meaningful.
Oh, wow, that's a lovely... I love that. I imagine that you... I also had a journey with the title of my book, and I imagine that we probably had some of the same working titles. Oh, it was all stuff like Dirty Little Secret and...
Really, I find, don't you find the titles, either you have like an amazing title right from the get-go, and I've actually written books because I had like an amazing title.
Really?
Yeah.
Like which one?
Like Adorkable, like one of my teen books. Yeah. A lot of the teen stuff, like Let's Get Lost, you know.
Yeah.
I'm very big on song titles. But then the other ones are just the ones where, you know, you just can't think of anything. The book is kind of written, you know, your editor is in a conference room in kind of London Bridge with a whiteboard, just coming up with things, and you're just like, no,
and
no.
The worst is when you're like, oh my God, I finally have it. I have the title. I have the amazing title. And you give it to them, and they come back a week later, and they're like, marketing hates it.
Yeah. Oh, just, and you know, really sort of quibbling with sort of like, no, you know, I think it should be there rather than and you know, title, and then titles can be really weird. It's like when I did The Rise and Fall of Becky Sharp, and it was like a modern take on Vanity Fair, what were we going to call it? That was just my working title, and everybody was like, well, great, that's the title.
Oh, easy.
Yeah,
lovely.
But just sometimes it's like a forceps delivery, isn't it?
It really
just like the worst thing. And then in the end, just like words, what are words? What
what
are they?
What is words? last question, because I will leave you to your... to your work. Have you ever thought about a film adaptation, and if so, who would play who?
Oh God.
In your dream casting.
Oh. Well, of course I would love a film adaptation.
Yeah.
I mean,
just for the cash, really.
Yeah, come on Netflix, get with it.
Oh man, I'd love this on Netflix.
I must admit, I don't think Netflix, everybody goes, oh, they just do like these amazing rom-coms. The rom-coms on Netflix, by and large, I think
you don't care. I thought Dumpling was very overrated.
I love Dumpling.
I liked the book.
The Kissing Booth just made me...
Oh, I didn't see that.
Cringe. Just awful. But and then they had this one that looked promising, and it had Lucy Liu as the heroine.
Oh,
the setup.
Yes, yeah. The
Shocking.
Setup, that was shite, yeah.
Yeah. But it's hard because, you know, I wrote it like 10 years ago now. So do you know who I really love, but I can't pronounce her name, and she's Irish, and you're just going to look at me now.
Saoirse Ronan?
Yeah.
Really? For Grace?
She'd make a really great Grace. How old is she?
No, she's, I think she's about my age. I think she's 27, 28.
But she could play younger.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because I just
good.
Really sort of love that idea as well, that Grace is kind of jolie-laid, as the French would say. She's kind of pretty ugly. So... Not that she's pretty ugly.
No,
but she's just
no, I know what you mean. I always like that thing of...
sort of a singular...
Yeah. I like that thing in the book of, like, it's very clear. And it's very clear that you've got this background in magazines as well of, like, beauty is a thing you pay for, you know? Like, this whole sense of her looking amazing because she has her spa
things.
Yeah,
all
her
of a sudden she's getting, like, you know, facials left, right and centre. Beauty is, like, it's the time... And it's like money. It's like, you know, I follow some like housewives.
Sure.
Caroline Stanbury from Ladies of London on Instagram. She just has like the most bizarre like beauty things every day where she's sort of going and having these like weird sort of things. She's like obsessed with the sleep lines. Who's got the time and money to
sleep
be obsessed
lines.
About sleep lines?
What's a sleep line?
Well, exactly. But, you know, it's her raison d'etre to kind of have them erased. And you know, I was in hospital recently and I was quite ill and I had to have oxygen. And I come back home and I get on Instagram and there's some, like, celebrity having, like, an oxygen thing. I was like, that oxygen was saving my life and you think it's doing something to your skin.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it is
that,
ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
So we'll have her as Grace, though.
Yeah, that'd be good.
And then him.
I think he should be older. Like, yes. I mean, but like even older than he is in the book. I think he seems to be
well, that's
visibly like
it's so
grey.
Interesting. I nearly got an American deal.
Really?
Sticky. And it was all great. And then when I actually got, like, their notes, I was just like, I'm not doing it.
Really?
It's kind of interesting that, you know, you will turn down the money.
What do they want to change?
They'd be like, he's too old.
He needs to be older. I thought he was too young. That was my only criticism.
He was too old. And it was just ridiculous things. They wanted her mother to die, basically, and for Grace and Vaughan to have, like, a rapprochement at the funeral. It was just that wow. thing of, you know, you don't want this book. You want
something else entirely.
Yeah, you know, and it was just... So I turned down the money.
Was it a lot of money?
It would have kept me going for a couple of years.
Wow.
It's kind of interesting. Johnny Geller... super agent, he does always say you always go with sort of like the money, but I don't think that's true. You know, I have turned down bigger offers for other books just because, you know, I really sort of felt in my heart of hearts
they didn't get where you were coming
from. Get it, or the strategy sort of wasn't right. Probably, you know, I'd probably sort of just be like rolling about on like a bed of sort of like 50s if I'd gone with it, but you know, I don't know who... Do you know, in my head, like, every romantic hero I write is, like, Dirk Bogarde in the 1962 film I Could Go On Singing with Judy Garland.
Aww.
Of just that kind of... I just find really sexy those quite buttoned-up, sort of quite old-fashioned, sort of English men. I don't know why, because in real life they all vote Tory and they're like gammons. They would just be awful.
I don't know why. I think I'm definitely saying this because I interviewed him recently, but I think a younger Richard E. Grant would be fabulous. As in with
that kind of, you know, that kind of sort of debonair kind of. But then I don't think, fuck, he's not fucked up enough. I just don't.
He's so fucked. He plays fucked up very well.
But I think there's a real darkness in Vaughan.
Yeah.
Something, you know, until he meets Grace, something quite malevolent, actually.
I mean, the adrenaline shot in the leg.
Yeah, do you know
what's
really funny?
That was a mental scene.
Somebody, when, because I heard about 50 Shades of Grey quite early on.
Yeah.
When it was, I think it was after it was a fanfic.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not forget, it was a Twilight fanfic. Mm-hmm. So it had come out as kind of this sort of, on this weird Australian sort of thing. And I remember I saw this blog review for Unsticky, and they were just sort of going, you know, we were hoping he'd be another Christian Grey, because all these women wanted was just sort of like more like 50 Shades of Grey. And they were just saying, you know, that, you know, Christian would never do that. He would never give somebody an adrenaline shot. And then when I read 50 Shades of Grey, like, he fucking like pussy whipped her and she was pregnant. Mm. How is that worse than giving somebody an adrenaline shot when they got flu? But
it's a mad scene, though. It's so brilliant. Like,
and no, I think it was really important that she does actually just say, "I hate you."
Yeah,
you know, you're not a nice person.
But and the fact that they don't break up after that. I mean, they do break up for a bit towards the end.
But then I think that's when she really kind of realizes, you know, who he is.
Yeah,
you know, and what I sort of really sort of liked as well. And this comes from like doing Pretty Women in feminist film studies, is, you know, that she kind of saves him from himself.
Yeah.
So it's not just he saves her. She does just as much as of the heavy lifting. You could just imagine what his life would be like.
Yeah, he would have just spun out for years and years doing the same thing and then just died alone, you know, probably quite young.
He'd have had a stress-related heart attack 5 years down the line.
I think one of the most romantic scenes in it was when she just gives him a shepherd's pie. So nice.
Who doesn't love a shepherd's pie?
It was really like, you know, when you're reading a Victorian novel and the character comes out of the rain and they've been in the rain for days, and then they're like, oh, here, have a hearty stew, and then you just the relief you feel. It was like that level of relief. Anyway, I better wrap this up because we have been here for absolutely ages. But Sarah, thank you so much for this lovely afternoon.
Thank you so much for coming and asking me loads of like lovely questions.
Oh, before we go, what is the next sort of thing we can hear or see from you? What should we look out for?
I'm resting at the moment. Well, hopefully the next thing I'm going to write is I'm going back to writing contemporary after a brief flirtation with period, and I'm going to be writing a novel that's inspired by Marjorie Hillis's 1936 guide, Live Alone and Like It.
Fabulous.
Yes.
That sounds great.
You can live alone and like it, and yet still be in love with somebody and have a fulfilling relationship.
You live alone.
I live alone.
Do you like it?
Love it.
What better a person? All right. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at zarolineodonoghue@gmail.com. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast produced by Hannah Varrell.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.